But I think if you've looked at what I've done since I took the judicial oath, that should convince you that I'm not an ideologue. And you and I agree that that's not the sort of person we want on the Supreme Court.
That's the nominee for the Chief Justiceship of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, today during his ongoing confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. We're going to be talking in just a moment with Amy White about those confirmation hearings. She has written a commentary in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled A Test of Principles and Ideas. Coming up after our conversation with Amy, Patty Skane joins us from Missouri Right to Life. We'll spend some time with her talking about that pro-life legislation that has passed the Missouri legislature, and it is going to the governor's desk, and it is expected to be signed. But I heard just this morning that pro-choice groups are already planning a court challenge to it. So, like so much of that legislation that passes in Missouri, good to see it passed, but whether it will become a law is a question mark still. We'll talk with Patty Skane about that. Evelyn Riley will join us later in the second hour of the program from the Massachusetts Family Institute. We'll spend some time with her talking about that ruling in Massachusetts yesterday. What did the legislature do? They turned down a constitutional amendment that would have banned gay marriage, but permitted same-sex unions. We'll find out whether that's bad news or good news when we talk with Evelyn Riley later in this hour. In the third hour of the program, Pastor John Berg will be our guest. We'll talk about what to do when bored in church, and admit it, it happens, doesn't it? I don't care how exciting your church is. In fact, I've never been so bored as I was sitting through what was supposed to be one of these exciting services, you know, with all the very loud music and all the pounding bass and drums and everything. Well, the songs just went on so long, it just bored me to tears. Never so bored in all my life. So even I can get bored, and I don't get bored very easy because I have such a very short attention span. Dr. Richard Stuckwish will join us in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. We'll discuss 3rd century bishop and martyr Cyprian of Carthage with Dr. Richard Stuckwish. Amy White was with us a little bit earlier today. We recorded a conversation with her. She's a corporate and political speechwriter and author of this commentary in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, A Test of Principles and Ideas. I began by asking Amy whether or not the opponents of John Roberts, who have been questioning him of late in the Senate Judiciary Committee, already know what kind of a justice Roberts will be.
I think they do know, Todd. I think they know from a long history in the legal profession. I think they know from the kinds of arguments he makes and the staff work that he's done for various administrations. But I think the most important reason why they know the kind of judge he'll be is that his own sworn testimony before the committee has indicated that he wants to be the justice that upholds only the rule of law.
So what are all the questions about? If everybody really knows what kind of a justice he's going to be, what his judicial philosophy is, why all these questions?
I think these questions are, for the most part, just an ability for politicians to grandstand about either their own issues or their desire to convince their constituents that they're giving Judge Roberts a careful examination. Most of the senators who have spoken and questioned him from the Senate Judiciary Committee have talked at length about legislation that they themselves have written. I know Joe Biden specifically mentioned a piece of legislation and then said, and I wrote that. Unlike some people here who claim to write legislation, I really wrote it, my little old self. And, you know, I was sitting at home listening to this, and I was like, oh, my gosh, this is just getting to the point of sheer embarrassment for some of these senators in terms of their desire to make the hearings really more about them than anything else. And we've seen a lot of examples of certain senators asking exactly the same kind of questions as you would expect from them as individuals based on their own Senate record.
So besides Senator Biden, who's always good for some entertainment
right, from
time to time, what other senators' questions, either in favor or opposed, stood out to you, Amy?
Well, Senator Kennedy stood out to me because he specifically talked about his desire to, as he phrased it, pass laws that would right wrongs, end injustice, and eliminate inequalities that we've witnessed so tragically in New Orleans. Now, that sounds like a pretty bold agenda for a lawmaker to accomplish. Were you under the impression that laws could be passed that would right wrongs, end injustice, and eliminate all inequality?
Well, they've been working on it for about 40 years or 50 years since the New Deal. And we still have, as you point out in your column, a fair number of poor people especially as evidenced by the victims of Katrina.
Well, that's right, because Senator Kennedy made took up a great amount of time talking about all the civil rights legislation, voting legislation, anti-discrimination legislation he's been involved in the past 30 to 40 years. None of that impacted the situation we found in New Orleans during the hurricane, and yet he's on the exact same track about anticipating a new future filled with new laws that will still fail to address the same old problems.
Now, where I noticed that from the very outset with the chairman's questions, it appeared to me that the chairman of the Judiciary Committee was trying to steal some of the thunder from everybody else. He got all the tough questions, it seemed, out on the table, with the exception of maybe the civil rights questions for the nominee. But he hit abortion right off the bat. How big of a factor is that issue going to be in the confirmation itself?
Well, I agree with your assessment that I think Chairman Specter really did desire to suck the air out of the room by immediately beginning with the very, very first set of questions to hit the Roe v. Wade issue, which is, of course, very primary in many people's minds. Conservatives care deeply about Roe v. Wade, as do liberals. And so it would only perhaps be those who describe themselves as moderate, who are disinterested in Roe v. Wade and the constitutional framework for it, whether or not it can truly hold up. So there's a lot of people who are very riveted on that issue, and I agree with you that Senator Specter really laid everything out, but that didn't stop people from returning to it. Dianne Feinstein went back to it, and she has announced publicly that she would not vote to confirm Judge Roberts if she thought he thought there was any basis for overturning Roe v. Wade. Now, that sounds like a litmus test to me, but she clearly had no issue announcing publicly that that would be enough to lose her vote. But she asked him, interestingly, after asking him about the right to privacy in Roe v. Wade, she then asked him about the right to be left alone on making decisions about end-of-life issues, as she called it, which is really just a dressed-up way of saying euthanasia. And it was interesting to see her go right from the Roe v. Wade idea of right to privacy, when there is absolutely, of course, no clear right to privacy in the Constitution, as Roe v. Wade cites it. And then she went to this idea of the right to be left alone. Roe v. Wade eliminated the opportunity for unborn Americans to be left alone in the womb, and this is an irony that completely is lost on her. She seems to have turned her significant advocacy efforts to those who want to kill people in the womb, those who want to kill those who are comatose or whose quality of life doesn't measure up, and those who want to give the freedom to people who have terminal illness or other life challenges before them to opt to kill themselves. So she's really carved out a very strange constituency for herself.
We're talking about the Roberts confirmation hearings. Amy White is our guest, author of a commentary in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled A Test of Principles and Ideas. Amy, one of the things I noticed on the whole right to privacy issue early on in the hearings was that Judge Roberts, when asked about right to privacy, found it almost everywhere in the Constitution. He was citing this amendment and that amendment to find various aspects of the right to privacy, all except the one articulated by the Roe Court.
Right, and I think that there were some pro-life advocates who were very heartened by that, because I think they saw in that a hint of what a lot of legal scholars, regardless of their personal beliefs, now acknowledge, that the Roe v. Wade case is bad law.
Did you expect Judge Roberts to answer these pointed questions about, well, they were put in many different ways, but essentially how would you rule questions?
You know, I did not expect him to answer that, and I think that the senators who are continuing to press him on this are simply trying to make a point to an uneducated viewer at home, hey, this guy doesn't want to answer our questions. Because we all knew going in that the judge is not supposed to commit himself to any point of view that might come up before him. The majority of constitutional legal issues have the chance of coming up before him, anticipating a 30-year tenure on the nation's high court. And Chairman Specter began these hearings and had said publicly for weeks ahead of time that he would not and should not answer those kinds of questions. So the senator to continue to ask questions that cannot be answered and then make a great show of crinkling their brow and frowning and sighing and throwing themselves back in their chair are just going for, you know, really cheap points with those who don't understand the process at home.
I have to wonder, because, you know, we live in an age of televised hearings. I have to wonder what this would have looked like, how much different these hearings would be, or any Supreme Court nomination confirmation hearings would be, if the TV cameras and the media weren't in the room.
Oh, my gosh, that would be, wouldn't that be interesting to be able to kind of play that out? I know one thing is for sure, they never would have had 11 hours of testimony on Tuesday. I mean, if you want to have a definition of cruel and unusual punishment, you have Judge Roberts who's sitting there for almost 11 hours straight answering questions, and out of 18 senators, at any given time, there was only a handful sitting there listening to the responses. I think that if they can make a judge sit there and do that, then as a common courtesy, all 18 should have to sit there for just as long.
Here's the bottom line for me, and maybe I'm just looking at this far too simply, Amy, but I know that today they're having testimony from various witnesses in favor and against, and they're bringing in people from various ethnic groups. I think the point is trying to be made that, you know, maybe there's a civil rights problem here, or maybe he's really in favor of civil rights and all that kind of stuff. But these hearings, for me, are really always and only about abortion when it comes to the Supreme Court. Am I being too simple in my view of this?
No, I don't think you are, because I think that it's an issue that has deeply divided America right down to its roots. It's divided churches and denominations. It has divided families. There are passionate feelings on both sides. And, you know, abortion is one of those issues that it was not as if the conscience of the country had decided over the course of many years to make something acceptable that was not acceptable. Instead, you had the court impose a ruling that demanded that every state in the union, independent of its constituency or its elected representatives, make abortion available. And I think that America has suffered tremendously. Our political systems have suffered. The credibility of the court has suffered as a result of imposing something that is not the true will of the people. Now, if you look at poll results, over the past decade or so, you usually see a majority of Americans who seem to have made peace with Roe v. Wade and have bought into the arguments that society will fall apart if we don't provide a legal means of getting rid of unwanted children. But I think it's compelling that, you know, we haven't seen a drop in child abuse or in neglect or in anything else that we were promised would be the good consequences of allowing abortion on demand. And I think that now people are really looking at the record, and we're beginning to see those surveys and those polls and research results that are showing that once again we have a majority of Americans who are willing to say, I don't agree with Roe v. Wade.
Amy White is a corporate and political speechwriter. She's author of a commentary in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled A Test of Principles and Ideas. You can read it in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, or you can go online and read it there at stltoday.com, stltoday.com. That's the website for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Amy, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, in a few minutes, we're going to be talking with Patty Skain about this pro-life legislation that was also in the paper. This is, in fact, in the A section of today's paper, Blunt. I don't even recognize the St. Louis Post-Dispatch letterhead anymore, because now they've got all this new fonts that they're using. Yet, straight out of our paper, Blunt gets bill tightening abortion rules. That's the latest from the Missouri legislature. We will spend some time with Patty Skain talking about that. And then, in just a few minutes, Evelyn Riley of the Massachusetts Family Institute will update us on another story that was in the news, this ruling by the Massachusetts legislature. Yesterday, what they did was they turned down a constitutional amendment in that state that would have banned gay marriage but permitted civil unions. We'll find out whether that's good news or bad news in just a few minutes here on Issues Etc. We'll also be hearing later in this hour from Michael Newdow, famous atheist, on the whole issue of the pledge again, and some response from someone who believes that the pledge deserves to have under God in its wording. That's a little bit later in this hour. Coming up November the 11th, Friday, November the 11th, here in St. Louis, a conference that you don't want to miss. Now, if you're one of the listeners who greatly values the pro-life emphasis of Issues Etc., one of our mottos is defending life from beginning to end. The Image of God Bioethics Conference, Friday, November the 11th, here in St. Louis, is the conference for you. It features some of the very best guests from our program and also from around the world on the issues that are affecting bioethics today. It'll be held here in St. Louis. For more information, for an actual brochure that will give you cost and location and everything else you need to know, go to our website, issuesetc.org. Now, there on the homepage, what you want to look for is the Image of God Bioethics Conference logo. Click on it, and it'll take you directly to that information. Issuesetc.org. God willing, we will be broadcasting live from the Image of God Bioethics Conference when it comes to us in November. And so you'll have an opportunity to not only watch the program in progress, we'll hope to be snagging some of those speakers at the conference as guests on the program Friday, November the 11th here in St. Louis. Issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org. Now, it's always encouraging, and I think maybe Missouri residents get a slightly skewed view of how things are in the United States, because of late, pro-life legislation has been doing pretty well in Missouri. In fact, Missouri is gaining a reputation for being a pro-life leader when it comes to how its lawmakers are voting, and thank God for that. I'm not a Missouri resident. I reside in the state next door in Illinois, and believe me, it's a whole different world. Well, some of the legislation that has passed through the Missouri legislature lately has to do with my home state, or I should say my adopted home state, and whether or not Illinois can, in effect, export abortion to Missouri minors. You might have heard that some of this legislation passed and is now on the governor's desk. We'll be talking with Patty Skane about that in a few minutes. Then, Evelyn Riley will be our guest. We'll talk to her about the Massachusetts amendment. Now, I'll give you a little hint here. She's not so worried that this amendment that would ban gay marriage but allow civil unions didn't pass. In fact, she's downright happy about it. We'll find out why in just a few minutes as we talk with Evelyn Riley. And then, Pastor John Berg, have you ever been bored in church? I remember, oh my goodness, I remember my childhood days sitting in the pew, mom, dad, and all five boys. Our postures were not ideal. Generally speaking, one of us, if you were lucky, you could position yourself next to mom or to dad, and you could lean your head over, or as my son likes to do it, sometimes just lay over completely. Now that as he gets a little bit older, we're doing our best to get him to participate. He loves to sing, and so he does a lot of singing during the church service. It's his way of participating. But boredom isn't something that only affects the little ones in the course of a church service. What do you do when bored in church? Pastor John Berg, pastor of Lamb of God Lutheran Church in Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, will join us in the third hour of the program to talk about that. Dr. Richard Stuckwish joins us to round off today's program. Cyprian of Carthage, he was both a bishop and a martyr. Two days ago, the church remembered Cyprian. Now, we're talking about a very, very ancient Christian father. We're going to find out exactly what Cyprian contributed to the thinking, the writing of the Christian church in the last 25 minutes of Issues, etc. Now, that open lines is coming up here in a little while. We'll be hearing from Michael Newdow. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Newdow is making a case that it is offensive to atheists to have the words "under God" in the pledge. As offensive, he says, as if the pledge were to say, "one nation which doesn't recognize God." He said that would offend people who believe in God. Well, he says, put yourself in our shoes. We atheists, when we hear the word "under God," it offends us equally. We'll hear a response to that. You know, he's got a point. I want to know what you think of his reasoning during open lines near the end of this hour. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're going to move Patty Skane around and go directly to our interview that we had earlier with Evelyn Riley. She's director of public policy for the Massachusetts Family Institute. Now, this ruling in the Massachusetts legislature yesterday failed to pass an amendment, defeated an amendment to the Massachusetts Constitution that would have banned gay marriage but permitted same-sex unions. I began by asking Evelyn, is this good news or bad news for those who are opposed to same-sex marriage?
No, Todd, it really wasn't. We have been lobbying to have the amendment defeated because what it would stand in the way of the new amendment, which would define marriage in our Constitution as only between a man and a woman. The petition, or rather the amendment that was defeated yesterday, would define marriage as the union of a man and a woman, but at the same time, it would enshrine civil unions in the Constitution as well. So that was a fatally flawed amendment that was supposed to be a compromise, but it pleased no one. So it was not a difficult thing to defeat it because neither side wanted it.
So how much of your lobbying do you think went into or affected the 157-39 vote against this piece of legislation, this amendment?
Well, the first time it was voted on last year, it passed by 104-92. So dozens of legislators switched their votes when we requested that the amendment not pass.
So what's the real difference between the amendment that you would like to have passed in Massachusetts and the one that went down to defeat yesterday?
Well, the one that went down to defeat, as I said, would also establish civil unions in the Constitution. The one that we are proposing would not. It's just on marriage, and it because Massachusetts is the only state in the union that has so-called same-sex marriages, which was declared to be so by the court, it would be very difficult, if not unconstitutional, to try to nullify the marriages that have taken place so far. So this amendment does not do that. It would say, it says that as of the effective date of this amendment, then marriages are defined as the union of a man and a woman. So it would not touch, or it does not address existing marriages.
Now, you can understand some of the confusion. The picture that goes along with the story from the Associated Press in our local paper here has a picture of two women, both supporters of gay marriage, according to the line underneath the picture, embracing a great joy and saying, "Thank you, Massachusetts." It would appear that the message being sent by the press here is this is a victory for those who are in favor of gay marriage.
Well, yes. The other side is trying very hard to claim that it's totally a one-sided victory, but that's not the case.
When we come back from this break, we'll continue our conversation with Evelyn Riley, Director of Public Policy for the Massachusetts Family Institute, talking about that ruling by the Massachusetts legislature yesterday on gay marriage. She says it's not bad news. They've got something better lined up, a better amendment, an amendment that would leave unaddressed the issue of civil unions so that they can deal with that legislatively as well. When we come back, I'll ask her about Governor Mitt Romney's views on these things and why it is that what, you know, in Massachusetts, when this thing happened, we were told that it was going to revolutionize the way people think about marriage. How many people have been married in Massachusetts under these new statutes? And has anything changed in Massachusetts since they adopted gay marriage? The rest of our conversation with Evelyn Riley coming up after this break. And then we'll be talking with Patty Skane of Missouri Right to Life about the legislation in the Missouri House that is sitting on Governor Matt Blunt's desk for a signature. It's good pro-life legislation. Will it ever see the light of day, even if it does see the governor's signature? And then we've got open lines to round off this second hour of the program. We'll hear from Michael Newdow, famed atheist. Yes, he's talking again about those words, under God, and it'll be open lines for your questions and comments. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The niche specialty of LCMS World Relief, along with disasters getting 95% of the dollar given to aid victims, we are determined that that aid be very closely connected with local Christians, local congregations, so the connection between Christ and caring for people is one that remains together. That's who Christ was. He loved people, word and deed. That's what the church does, I'm convinced, on the basis of the New Testament.
That's Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief. For more information, look for the LCMS World Relief logo on our website, issuesetc.org, or call 314-996-1683. LCMS World Relief.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The abstinence-only approach to sex education is proving effective in curbing teen pregnancy and the rate of STDs among young people. Now, two comprehensive sex education advocacy groups are challenging government funding of such programs, saying there isn't adequate oversight of them. Kim Troby has reaction.
Advocates for Youth and CECAS are using the Data Quality Act, a little-used law, to force the Department of Health and Human Services to look into all abstinence-only curricula. Linda Klepacki of Focus on the Family Action suggests the government dig a little deeper.
There has been no oversight of these programs from Planned Parenthood and CECAS because they haven't been looked through. They are coming against abstinence education, and for the first time, that opens up the door both ways.
Klepacki contends abstinence education is bad for their business.
We actually are getting funded at a larger level, and when we're getting funded larger in abstinence education, comprehensive sex education funding is going to go down. So they're seeing it in their pocketbook. They're going to come after us.
Libby Gray Mackey directs Project Reality, a national abstinence education program.
I think these groups are scared and nervous because abstinence education is so successful in reaching students with the message, and the students are listening.
She says the action may be short-lived if Health and Human Services decides to shine a light on both sides' curricula.
All the federal government needs to do is to examine and get the explicit and graphic information that these two groups are giving to children, and they'll probably drop this whole idea of a case.
Neither Advocates for Youth or CECAS returned phone calls for comment. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
A congressional report found 11 of the 13 abstinence programs contain medical inaccuracies, but Klepacki says all have been proven false or corrected. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Do you want more of God's grace? Village Lutheran Church in Ladue is a Bible-believing church faithful to the Scriptures, a place for the whole family, a community that cares with a vibrant, historic Christian liturgy. Village Lutheran Church is located at 9237 Clayton Road in Ladue. www.villagelutheranchurch.org. Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, 314-993-1834.
Was the Book of Mormon given to Joseph Smith by an angel or created from a work of fiction? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is titled, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon? You can find out more by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or look for the cover of Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon on our website, issuesetc.org.
You saw the picture in the Nation section of today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Kristen Steinbach and Robin Oakes of Massachusetts embracing. One of them holds a sign, Thank You, Massachusetts. Robin and Peg, May 17, 2004. They're so happy. Why? Well, apparently they're happy because the Massachusetts legislature turned down an amendment that would ban gay marriage and permit civil unions. Well, we're talking with Evelyn Riley. She says that's not bad news for the opponents of same-sex marriage. They have something better in the offing. If you were like me, you thought, wow, that's not good news. But it turns out they're planning ahead in Massachusetts. Evelyn Riley is director of public policy for Massachusetts Family Institute. Our conversation earlier today continues. I asked her how many gay couples have been married since May 17th, 2004.
The media is saying over 6,000.
Is that an accurate number as far as you can tell?
Well, I keep seeing that number, so I'm assuming it's correct.
How do you respond to those who say, look, it's been a while now, Massachusetts has had legalized same-sex marriage, not much has changed, the only thing that's changed is that people who want to get married, anybody who wants to get married, can now get married?
Well, we keep hearing that the sky hasn't fallen, but our response is that we don't expect the worst consequences to be immediate. As we see in Europe, that it takes at least a decade before the full impact is felt. And the way it is felt is that people don't get married anymore. So the rate of marriages has fallen drastically in countries that have either same-sex marriage or or the equivalent, like civil unions, the rate of marriage is falling, and the rate of children born to unwed parents is rising drastically.
What do you think the specific connection is there, Evelyn?
Well, I think the specific connection is that marriage is a unique institution between a man and a woman. If you start making it mean anything else other than that, then it loses its meaning. And people just don't think it's important anymore. And that any relationship at all is equivalent to marriage. So it loses its meaning.
What about the timeline for the amendment you mentioned a few minutes ago that would ban both same-sex marriage and civil unions?
It doesn't ban civil unions. It doesn't address civil unions.
It just leaves it unaddressed entirely.
It leaves it unaddressed. So,
what's the timeline for then that amendment?
That amendment, beginning next week, we will have to collect over almost 66,000 signatures certified. So to make sure they're all certified, we need to collect probably double that at least to assure that we get that many certified. So we have 60 days to do that.
And then what would happen?
Then those signatures go to the Secretary of State, who then does another, well, they have to go to the town halls to be certified. Then they go to the Secretary of State in December. And then there's an opportunity for the other side to challenge the signatures. And once all that is through, then they go to the legislature.
What do you think the prospects of that amendment will be in the legislature?
I think they're very good, because we feel we have at least 60 legislators who would support it at this point, if not more, and we only need 50.
Any idea of the position of Governor Mitt Romney there in Massachusetts on that next bit of legislation, that next
amendment? Oh, yes, he's endorsed it.
Has he come out and talked about his view on civil unions?
He opposes civil unions. He has always, even before he ran for, when he ran for the governor's office the first time around, he opposed both homosexual marriage and civil unions.
Now, slightly off the subject, but still on the subject of Governor Romney, he's been very clear on his issue on the gay marriage position, and that's been in the forefront ever since Massachusetts stepped into this issue. What about on the life issue? Because Romney's being looked at by many as a potential presidential candidate for 2008.
Well, when he first ran against Kennedy a long time ago for the Senate, he was originally very pro-life, and then he seemed to be waffling as the election came closer, and I suspect that's maybe the reason he didn't win that time. But because, you know, the pro-life people won't get behind someone who is not solid. This time around, and I think through the process of studying the stem cell issue, I think he became much more understanding of the nature of an embryo. And he's taken a much stronger pro-life position, and he now calls himself pro-life.
Finally then, Evelyn, back to the issue of gay marriage. Can you give us any idea on where the electorate, where the citizens of Massachusetts stand, according to the polls, on the issue of gay marriage and on the issue of same-sex unions?
Well, we did a poll a couple of years ago. I think things have shifted somewhat with the national sweeping of all of these amendments to protect marriage. I think that's been one influence. Another influence, we see that the polls nationally have gotten more conservative since the Lawrence versus Texas decision legalizing sodomy. And I think as these things become more part of people's consciousness, they tend to become more conservative. Also, Massachusetts is probably similar, I would think, to Oregon. I believe it was Oregon, where they took a poll on people's attitudes toward homosexual marriage and civil unions. And when they actually got to vote on it, the number of people who voted in favor of the amendment was 10 points higher than the polls had said people were. And that's been generally true, that when they take polls on this issue, people don't always want to reveal their position. But in the ballot box, they do.
MAFamily.org is the website for Massachusetts Family Institute, MAFamily.org. Evelyn Riley is Director of Public Policy for the Massachusetts Family Institute. Evelyn, thanks for your time, and thanks for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Oh, by the way, the website for the signature campaign is voteonmarriage.org.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Patty Skane is our guest for the next few minutes here on Issues, Etc. We're going to talk about the pro-life legislation that passed through the House in Missouri and is sitting on Governor Blunt's desk. Patty Skane is a regular guest on the program. She is president of Missouri Right to Life, based in Jefferson City. Patty, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you.
All right, what is the nature of the legislation that now awaits the governor's signature?
Well, the legislation basically does three things. It requires allows any parent whose minor child has been taken for an abortion without their consent to have civil recourse and to be able to sue that individual. And that may be it may be a school counselor. It may be, and that's some of the opposition. It might be a clergyman. It may be anyone who tries to circumvent the parental consent law here and take a minor for an abortion. And it doesn't necessarily have to be out of state. They could, if some person were to take a minor and sign as their parent, that would also qualify, even if it was here in Missouri. It does two other things. It kind of restricts who the next friend can be, as far as when a minor goes to court to get permission for an abortion without parental consent, the judge selects or appoints a next friend for the minor, and this legislation restricts who that can be so that no one with a financial interest in whether or not that minor has an abortion can be appointed in that position. And the third thing it does is that it requires that doctors that do abortions have clinical privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of the abortion clinic, so that if an emergency arises, then that will facilitate them getting that person admitted to a hospital for emergency care.
Are you expecting for there to be any kind of legal maneuvers or challenges to this bill, even as it receives the governor's signature?
Right, I'm sure that they will. They've already stated that they intend to file suit in the federal courts. That will go, unless something's changed up there recently, but I don't think it has. Apparently, in Jackson County, and it will go to Scott Wright probably, and who is not sympathetic to the pro-life cause, and so therefore the first level in the federal courts, they will file an injunction and ask to have the law enjoined until the court cases are all decided. But once it gets to that first level of the federal courts, it would go into the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, and I would think that at that point we have a much better chance of getting a good decision, because there's never been any argument, and even in the legislature while these things were being discussed, that any of this is unconstitutional.
There's a quote in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch from Allison Gee, who's associated with Planned Parenthood of St. Louis region, and her reaction to the passage of the bill was that she thought it was at least in some way hopeful for abortion rights advocates. She said that the bill contains a mere fraction of the anti-abortion agenda, and the fact that the anti-abortion majority could not pass a stronger bill suggests there's disagreement on how far to push the anti-abortion agenda. How do you respond to Allison Gee's comments there?
That really is not the case. I mean, there was a bill in the regular session that had more in it, and certainly when those issues come back up, we will support those as well. And I think the pro-life citizens and the pro-life groups that are active at the Capitol all agree that those are important issues, and I expect that certainly in the next couple of years that we will see many of those things passed. I'm sure you're aware that the legislation that I'm referring to from the regular session that had three or four more other things in it became complicated by some language that the cloning research institutes, et cetera, uncomfortable with, and that's what kind of led that legislation to get off track.
So are you referring to the amendments that were defeated that were on the existing legislation or a separate piece of legislation?
Well, I'm referring to the regular session when the bill...
Oh, the regular session,
right,
yes.
When there was
okay.
a bill with more of these issues in it. And she's trying to indicate that somehow there's some disagreement in the pro-life groups and in the pro-life citizens of Missouri that as to how far we should go on abortion regulation, and that's not the case. That legislation was simply derailed in a way by some opposition to some of the language by the cloning institutes and the cloning research people.
Were you aware of any protests during this special session?
Oh, there was a rally at the Capitol on a Wednesday. It was, purported has been organized, I know, for several weeks, and supposed to have quite a number of people there. And there really were, we saw probably no more than just around 100 people at the most at the Capitol. So as much as they seem to be terribly upset by this legislation and what it might do to abortion clinics, you know, there really wasn't a large opposition at the Capitol on Wednesday.
You know, the odd thing about it is that the legislation, at least the part that has to do with abortion clinics per se, said more about abortion clinics in Illinois than it did about Missouri. I know that there was the provision about having abortion providers being having hospital privileges, and that would apply to Missouri abortion providers. Any news from Illinois on this particular passage?
Well, actually, the clinic there in Illinois has indicated that they will change their procedures to comply with this law. Of course, I'm sure they know that it will, be challenged in court soon and possibly be enjoined. But they have indicated that they would change their procedures and actually in the article that I read said that they would make sure that a minor child was actually accompanied by a parent before they would do an abortion on him. And so, you know, whether that's genuine or not, I don't know, but they have responded. And, of course, as I said, if it goes into a court challenge and gets enjoined, they wouldn't have to abide by that until this court decisions were determined.
Well, the governor says that he'd like to sign it as soon as possible. What does as soon as possible mean as far as you know, Patty?
Actually, I believe that the governor is signing it possibly today.
And can we expect then, as you said before, almost immediate challenges or litigation involving this bill?
According to the, this is the way of all pro-life legislation, and it's unfortunate. Again, there, it was never even any indication during the arguments that this was unconstitutional language, which is, of course, what usually is the basis of any kind of court challenge. And so they're just, it's just another attempt to delay the legislation from going into effect. But we expect, of course, that once we get past this first stage of the federal courts, which will probably go to Scott Wright in Kansas City, that that it will be upheld.
Finally, with about 30 seconds here, Patty, what's next on the agenda for pro-life forces and legislators in Missouri?
Well, obviously, there are a number, again, as we talked before, of other issues that regulate abortion. Also very interested, of course, in pharmacy and pharmacist conscience rights and for anybody who doesn't want to be involved in the abortion issue or the prescription of abortifacients and that kind of thing. There are a number of other issues, and without a doubt, we will continue to try to ban all human cloning and stop the kind of embryonic stem cell research here in the state of Missouri that would destroy life. Missouri Right to Life, of course, and all the pro-life groups are very much in favor of adult stem cell research, which is ethical and has brought about many cures. They have treated at least 58 different kinds of diseases with using adult stem cells. That's not happening with embryonic stem cells, but they continue to push for a human cloning and the use of embryonic stem cells. And so we will continue to battle that, and it will continue to be a priority. It's probably, we encourage or we support all these other issues that may come up as far as abortion regulation, but the stem cell issue is going to continue to, and the cloning issue is going to continue to be a priority for us.
MissouriLife.org is the website address for Missouri Right to Life. MissouriLife.org. Patty Skane is president of Missouri Right to Life, based in Jefferson City. Patty, thanks for being our guest.
I'm actually executive director, but
executive
thank you.
Director.
Uh-huh.
Thank you
thank
very
you.
Much, Patty.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Well, here's something for the end of the hour that might pique your interest from the AP. Reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. Does this sound familiar? It's coming right back around again. Reciting the Pledge of Allegiance in public schools has been declared unconstitutional by a federal judge in the second attempt by an atheist to have the pledge removed from classrooms. The name is by now familiar. Atheist Michael Newdow. He lost his previous battle before the Supreme Court. Now, Judge Lawrence Carlton ruled that the pledge's reference to one nation, quote, under God violates school children's right to be, quote, free from a coercive requirement to affirm God. Carlton said that he was bound by the precedent of the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which in 2002, it's all coming back around. You remember this? In 2002, they agreed with Michael Newdow that the pledge is unconstitutional when recited in public schools. Now, the Supreme Court had said that Newdow lacked standing because he did not have custody of his elementary school daughter. And Newdow has since filed an identical case on behalf of three unnamed parents and their children. Judge Carlton says that those families do have the right to sue, so they do have standing. Let's hear from Michael Newdow himself. He says atheists are offended by the recitation of the pledge in public schools as it stands.
Imagine every morning if the teachers had the children stand up, place their hands over their hearts, and say, we are one nation that denies God exists. I think that everybody would not be sitting here saying, oh, what harm is that? They'd be furious. And that's exactly what goes on against atheists, and it shouldn't.
Okay, now at first I'm thinking when I hear this, he's got a point. If we did have a pledge that said, one nation that denies God exists, indivisible with liberty and justice for all, a fair number of people would be offended. Most of us wouldn't even want to say it, right? And the point he's trying to make is kind of put yourself in the atheist's shoes. You are requiring us to affirm something that we can't affirm according to our beliefs. It would be as if we were to require those of you who do believe in God to deny his existence. Now, that's about all the farther his point goes. There are two reasons why his point is just not that good. Number one, no one's required to say the pledge. If you say the pledge as it is, you can even just stop talking at the under God section. You could just say one nation, take a beat, indivisible, just go back to the old pre-1954 Pledge of Allegiance. You don't have to say it, even while everyone else around you is saying. But it's not compulsory to say the pledge at all. You can go out there and just stand with your hand over your heart or your hands in your pockets if you want to. I remember saying the pledge as a kid in grade school. We would walk out onto the lawn of the school, weather permitting. The Boy Scouts would raise the flag, and we would say the pledge. The other reason is that many people would consider the removal of the words under God from the pledge as the kind of denial that Michael Newdow is talking about. Now, Michael Newdow also says that the government should remove the words under God, which were only inserted in the pledge in 1954.
All it has to do is put the pledge as it was before to say that we are one nation, indivisible, instead of dividing us on religious basis.
So his goal here is, at least it sounds like he says his goal is, to unite us again. These words under God divide us on a religious basis. Then let's unite again by taking the words under God out. Now, look, let's understand his position. Before you start getting all worried about the atheist encroachment into society, let's understand his position. He's an atheist, and he's a principled atheist here. You know what's more interesting and more intriguing and really more appalling to me about this is the people who will say that we shouldn't be taking under God out of the pledge. You'll go to church on Sunday. And you'll sit with your cup of coffee with your fellow Christians and you'll say, they're trying to take the words of under God out of the pledge. And yet there's another place where God is being taken out. that we don't even bat an eye. Before we go to this break now, here is Jared Leland of the Beckett Fund on the other side of the pledge issue. He says the words under God in the pledge are a reflection of the American legal heritage.
We are a country that recognizes that rights are inalienable and come from something greater than the state, as Jefferson recognized in the Declaration of Independence. And simply the inclusion of the phrase under God in the pledge is a mere recognition of that.
Now, Jared Leland of the Beckett Fund also says that the words under God in the pledge really serve an entirely secular, non-religious purpose. Listen.
Our rights come from something greater than the state, and therefore they cannot be usurped at the will of the state, which is the very reason why in our Constitution we have a limited form of government as opposed to limited rights.
Now, he's making the case that there has to be some greater foundation for our laws. That's true. But he's also trying to make the case that the words under God really have no religious content. Isn't it ironic? The atheist is saying the words under God are packed full of religious content, and the Christian is saying the words under God are empty of religious content. Makes your head spin, doesn't it? Steve is calling from his car. Steve, welcome.
So what's the great ramification if they drop the words under God? I don't think God's going to be too offended by it. And I think what people forget that if you read the first part of the Constitution, the preamble says, we the people. And that's really the basis for the way our country was set up. I think the using the Declaration by Jefferson is more of a nicety, but that's not really the underpinnings. That's my thoughts.
Steve, thank you very much. Well, I don't know what God's going to think about it. I know what a lot of people say God's going to think about it. He'll remove his hand of blessing from our great nation. And you know what? The same people who are saying this, with their coffee cups in their hand on Sunday morning before they go into church, whining about taking God out of the public square, will go in and most likely listen to a sermon where the generic God of the under God of the Pledge of Allegiance will be in all of his generic glory, which isn't much. The beige God. He kind of shines at 40 watts. And he's completely bereft of religious content. It's not a God connected to the Christian God of Scripture, who is known only through the crucified and risen Jesus Christ. And the same people who will whine about taking God out of the pledge don't even bat an eye when God, as he is revealed in Jesus Christ, crucified and risen for sinners, is left out of the sermon on Sunday. Ted Haggard, we just talked to him the other day. Do we need to hear about Jesus crucified every Sunday? He said no. But you know what? I bet you he's writing letters right now about taking under God out of the pledge. Got no problem with taking Jesus out of the pulpit. A real problem with taking under God out of the pledge. Again, it makes your head spin. We'll be right back with Hour 3 of Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.